Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about our public conversations and how we might learn to communicate in a more human, emotionally intelligent and constructive way about the many, many things we disagree on. Every week, I talk to someone who, in some ways, involved in public debates, has some kind of public voice, to learn from them, challenge them and be challenged by them, and hopefully model a better conversation. I'm convinced that overcoming our own tendencies to tribalism and self-righteousness and building empathy with those we disagree with is hard work. It takes concentration and self-reflection. And I hope that by listening to a range of voices, people thinking about their values and saying a bit about their stories might help with this. In this episode, I spoke to Glyn Harrison. Before he retired, he was professor and head of department of psychiatry at the University of Bristol, where he was also a practicing consultant psychiatrist. He is a past president of the International Federation of Psychiatric Epidemiology, which I don't really know what that means, and I only found it out halfway through the podcast. So I hope to go back to him and speak to him about his time advising the WHO on epidemiology. Meanwhile, he's author of A Better Story, God, Sex and Human Flourishing, and The Big Ego Trip, Finding True Significance in a Culture of Self-Esteem. I hope you enjoy listening. Glyn, I'm going to throw you in the deep end with the big meaty question. No chit-chat, no small talk here, but you have had a bit of warning, so hopefully it's not too flummoxing. I want to hear your reflections on what you think you might hold sacred. And for new listeners, this continues to be very poorly defined, to be honest, but some of the sort of ways into it I've used are very deep principles, things that if someone tried to pay you to give up, you'd feel that kind of disgust reflex, that sense of that something sacrilegious in that. It doesn't have to be religious. It can be anything that you think you've circled around or tried to live by, even if haltingly so.
Well, I'm going to be a little naughty and I'm going to stick to the question, but alter the order of the words ever so slightly, because, and we might want to come back to this, I think the question itself reflects something about a society in which I get to say what's sacred. And what I'd like to do is say what sacred thing holds me, Elizabeth. Come at it that direction. It's the same really, but just come at that direction. And I think there are two things I could mention, particularly important. The first is the sense of the sacred. I think the sense of the numinous, the other. The sacred itself, or what we might call the non-rational side to religious experience. That is really important in my life, has been since I was a little boy. And so that accompanies me through all of this, through all of the intellectual stuff and thinking through that sense of proximity of the sacred itself is really big, I think, for me. The other thing, that sacred thing that holds me is what I let's call it the Christian understanding of what it means to be human. Essentially, that humans are made in the image of God. I think that's deeply sacred because, of course, to be the image of God is to be sacred in some way. To see other human beings as sacred, and that's something that's very close to me too. And yeah.
I ask the question and then in some ways move on for it rather than digging, not because I don't think it's important, but because it's the beginning of someone thinking about something often rather than a kind of definitive answer of what they, or perhaps more realistically their community or their groups of belonging, have formed in them as sacred. So
yeah, and I do see it very much as a reflection of the spirit of the age. You know, it's that I get to define, I get to construct. It's about me in the end. So a bit of a pushback, I guess, against that. But
it's all right. Classic academic trying to get me to define my terms. It's good. So because I do think that it's something that forms us and is comes through the places that we've been and the families that we've been in, I like to wind back to give people a sense of people's stories, to locate them in a narrative. So you're retired, you've had an illustrious career, and we'll talk a bit about that. But I want to go right back to Glyn as a little boy. Tell me a little bit about where and how you grew up, and particularly if there were any big ideas that you think have formed you for good or ill throughout your life.
Well, I had the weirdest childhood in many ways. Really happy, you know, I've got wonderfully happy memories of childhood, but I was brought up in the Salvation Army. And, you know, compared with other kids at the time, I put on a uniform on Sundays. I spent my Sundays playing a cornet around at the old people's homes in the afternoon, or marching the streets in the morning, or as a teenager, my Saturday evening selling war cries in pubs, from pub to pub. You know, other kids weren't doing this. And so I had a deeply rooted sense of being different, you know, being dissonant with culture, that one was marked out with this bizarre Victorian uniform at the time. And yet, as I say, it was a really richly textured, very working class childhood, richly textured in all kinds of ways. And certainly, I mentioned when I talked about my sense of the sacred, a connection there going way back to childhood, and that I can remember sitting in Salvation Army halls. And of course it was pietistic, but I've got quite a wide emotional bandwidth, I guess, and so that kind of pietism met a need too, I think, for an emotional expression to my
explain the term pietism for those who might not have heard it.
Well, you know, it goes out of 18th century, the Wesleys in some ways were, you know, pietistic, in that there's a focus on the non-rational, the more emotional. One might link it with the sense of the cozy, the homespun, the sense of closeness to God that doesn't overwork things intellectually, but is more easily and more readily satisfied with that sense of emotional connection with God. Yeah, it's a hard one to define, actually. But,
so would it be contrasted with something like a more high church, more sacramental tradition?
Yes, it would certainly be a simplified sense of Jesus is my personal saviour, and you'd sing along to that. So it wasn't structured in a liturgical sense, and it certainly didn't have the more, you know, it doesn't have the more cognitive, rational side of conservative evangelicalism, much more emotionally cozy.
And it sounds like perhaps it wasn't an obvious thing for you to go onto this medical and academic career in psychiatry. You know, had members of your family been to university before? What was the journey to get there?
Well, Ed, it was really interesting. I was the first from the family to go to university, and there were no role models for that. And there's an interesting background to that, because my mother was told she'd never have kids. And she had a heart condition. And when my father saw her father with a, you know, wanting to, said, "I'd like to marry your daughter," he very seriously took him into the next room and said, "You need to know she'll never have children. And then even worse, she'll never scrub floors because of this heart condition." I think not scrubbing floors was going to be worse than not having children. But my dad, you know, he said, "Well, I'll have her anyway," you know. But they married thinking that this was going to be, you know, she was very vulnerable, never have kids. And then she got pregnant, and the kid, that little boy was stillborn. Weirdly, they called him Glyn, and then two or three, four more years go by, and that's it, they think. And then suddenly she gets pregnant, and now along comes this second chance, and weirdly they call him Glyn. And so that burdened me through my childhood with a sense of being both special, but also needing to prove it in some way. And I think that accounts for the sense of drivenness that people would say of me. That's part of that. And Glyn grew up with, you know, this great sense of having to prove he was special in some way. My sister came along quite a few years later, so effectively an early childhood those early days. And I guess you could link that with my interest in self-esteem later on, because it does lead you to ask at a personal level, well, on what thing do I base my sense of worth? When is enough achievement enough? But yeah, so I failed the 11 plus boldly. By that, I mean, I failed it twice. So, but thankfully, I managed to get into a very early experimental comprehensive system and worked from there into the grammar stream. And then I'd always wanted to be a doctor, and then made it to university. And things were going swimmingly as far as my parents, I guess, were concerned, until I announced that I wanted to be a psychiatrist, which then didn't suit at all. But there we were.
Because it sounded like quackery, do you think it was a kind of, it was the Christian suspicion of it, or was it just foreign to them?
Well, partly foreign, but also because you're not a proper doctor, really. And everybody knows that psychiatrists have, and still do, I think, share the stigma of their patients. And so there's that sense of, you know, being other on the outside. Maybe less so today. I don't know. What do you think?
That was a new thought to me. I do find, I'd love to talk more about it, I do find the whole field quite mysterious. It feels like you have kind of psychology, psychotherapy, these ways in which your kind of average person might come into contact with, and then psychiatry, which does feel quite like something happening that you sort of want to not have to come into contact with it in your life, and therefore no experience of it is good experience. Do you have a kind of shorthand for what the field is and what drew you to it?
No, there's no shorthand for what the field is. It attends to the breakdown or dysfunction of mental processes, so much as a physician attends to the dysfunction of physical processes. That is it. It's based on the model that the mind can go wrong in the way it is made to work, and psychiatrists are drawn into the field with that basic medical model in mind, and so they harness both, you know, medical skills, medical methodology, looking for what's wrong here, and grouping things into diagnoses and so on, but also reaches beyond the medical model to bring in other perspectives, you know, sociology, psychology, philosophy even, and it was that drew me to it.
And I guess it's two interlocking questions. I'm always interested in those who have grown up with their faith, if they have had a crisis or crises or time away from it. But I guess I'm interested in particularly in the context of that field, academia in general, possibly psychiatry, certainly mental health in particular, I don't think of as a place where there are many, many Christians, or where that is naturally has a culture that is very open to that religious point of view. So was it challenging as you went into that field? Did you kind of reset your beliefs? How did it affect you spiritually?
Yes, it's an interesting misconception, actually. There aren't many Christians in psychiatry. At the moment, there are lots. You'll find Christians all over the place in psychiatry. It's certainly true that when I went into it I went into it in the mid-70s. At that time, there were fewer, and it was seen as a rather adventurous thing to do. But even when I did psychiatry in Bristol, and I went to work there with one of the few consultant psychiatrists who were committed evangelical Christians, to use that label at the time. There were relatively few. There are many now in psychiatry, but at the time, but I was privileged to be part of quite a large group of trainees around the Bristol area, the Southwest area, who were also committed Christians. And it was at the time of Francis Schaeffer. There was a renaissance among evangelical Christians at that time of interest in philosophy, of different perspectives, worldviews, all of that was germinating. And so it was a very stimulating time to be part of it. And also, to be honest with you, psychiatry was much less threatening then because it was being assailed from many different sides as being somehow the answer to the big questions of human existence. You know, that's where Christians worry. They say, well, aren't you getting in something which offers an alternative view of what it means to be a human being and how we flourish as human beings? Well, how can you possibly do that? But actually, at that time, psychiatry was being assailed from lots of different angles as having failed and fundamentally failing to be able to do that. And so you had the anti-psychiatry movement, David Cooper, R.D. Lang, the human potential movement in the 70s that was getting on board. And so I became involved in lots of those things and realized that all of these things gave a partial insight into the complexity of the human condition. None were able to integrate, I think, those questions satisfactorily in a way which for me, ultimately and fundamentally, my Christian faith does. So it wasn't as hard, to be honest, as many people think.
Where do you think we are with the kind of science, religion conversation? I always hesitate to label it debate because one of the bugbears about it is you have this kind of narrative of clash, which is very overblown. But certainly, I think still for a lot of people, they're surprised when those with a scientific bent are also religious Orthodox Christians or other. Do you feel like over the course of your career, as you've seen it ebb and flow, we're in a period where the understanding of how these different approaches and these different fields can complement each other is growing? Or do you feel like we're still in very much a kind of binary of a materialistic or a physicalist worldview versus everyone else?
Well, you know, in recent years, there's been a, you know, particularly with the Dawkins phenomena, the new atheist, that there has been a resurgence of that binary, I think. And people like John Lennox have been much more involved in making the case than I've been interested in doing. And I think the case is fundamentally the difference between the, you know, the how or the what and the why. I think that still is the critical difference between the questions that science can answer and the question that faith can answer. And I do see them as being complementary modes, complementary ways of thinking about life. So it hasn't greatly worried me. I think there are some really challenging areas. You know, I think to reduce the question to, well, science talks about the what rather than the why, but actually evolutionary science, for example, and evolutionary psychology does try to explain a lot of the why as well. So it tries to explain why we're religious. It's because we survive when we see hidden connections between things. We're more likely to be alert to potential threats where we're sensitive to hidden connections. And therefore, religious faith is a byproduct of that evolutionary phenomena, that ability to survive. So when people say to me, it's very simply about the difference between the why and the what, it's not quite as simple as that. Evolutionary psychology does try to answer quite a bit of the why as well. So I don't think it's simple. I think it's an ongoing conversation. But the more you know about science, to be honest, that I feel the less troubled you are, because of course you know its limitations. And certainly that you were seeing it in public health at the moment with epidemiology. That was my particular interest, epidemiology. And the more you know about epidemiology, the more you quake at the moment when you hear government ministers saying, we follow the science, you know, the science, as if there is such a thing as the science. There are numerous scientists and epidemiologists with their models and the different assumptions they put into the models, and the status hierarchies and the jockeying position and all of the ego, and all of that goes on in this. And of course, if you're in that world as I was, you've got to take some of that with a pinch of salt, some of that arrogance of science. you know.
What's your prediction about what the role of science and the role of expertise will be? Because I think the way I've heard it narrated is we were done with experts, or at least some, you know, Michael Gove, just one person we can quote, but that people feel the longing for certainty and for objectivity, and that actually this might be a time for the resurgence of experts. But you and other scientists that I'm speaking to are saying almost that could be a poison chalice, because this is right at the edge of science's ability, you know, fast moving, fast changing, novel, no existing longitudinal data, you know, that if this is what science is judged on, it can't help but fail. What's your kind of hunch?
Well, you know, science is always a tool of the humans who are involved in it. Ultimately, how we use the findings that we produce is always going to be sensitive to the way humans want things to be and to see things. And particularly the more complex the questions. I mean, the rigors of the scientific method, of course, which are there to prevent those biases of human, you know, what we want to be the case. You know, the scientific method is there to be objective. It works very well at a physicalist level and in the area of, say, physics, chemistry and matter. But where you've got more complex questions of human behavior, then the certainty, the confidence interval around your estimates widens. And we are making lots of statements at the moment without qualifying just how large those confidence intervals are. And so I think science is always a tool that will be used and also misused by human beings. And these things ebb and flow. So when it suits us, we curse the experts. But now it very much suits us to have the experts as a cover. And so they're back in. So I think it's a rather good example of the, what we might call the politicization of science. You know?
Yeah. You wrote a book called The Big Ego Trip in 2013. Looking at it now, it seems to me to be quite prescient, because I remember when it came out thinking, oh, that's an interesting thesis. And then a few years later, it becoming, and maybe this was just the trickle down to lay people like me, but it became obvious that there was a growing consensus of the damage that the kind of self-esteem movement had done, and that the social science that had been based on was questionable, and that it had kind of deep-reaching effects in education and in parenting. Did you feel at the time like you were saying something that needed to be heard and wasn't generally understood, or was I just late to catch up?
Well, I was definitely riding a growing tide of discontent in psychology, but although a lot of, you know, even until the turn of the millennium, the top three topics of, if you look at the topics that were most published on in psychology, self-esteem was still up there in the top three. So there's a huge amount of literature generated, but there's also a growing sense of unease about this whole thing. And there was quite an important review carried out by Roy Baumeister, an American psychologist, who started his career actually as a great advocate of self-esteem, but he then put a more objective hat on and went through it. It wasn't a systematic review, so it's not perfect by any means, but it was a good and comprehensive review. And he said, if you look at efforts to boost self-esteem, where these have been evaluated systematically in terms of the promises that have been made, you know, boosting your self-esteem will improve educational outcomes, mental health outcomes, general social well-being. Why, the governor of California in the mid-80s even thought that if they could institute this statewide self-esteem thing, people would pay more taxes. You know, it would be so good for us. And so you have these outrageous claims that were made. And it was only relatively late in the day, I think 2003, when Baumeister got around to doing that, that someone says, hang on a minute, if you look really carefully at the trials that have been carried out, there is just no evidence that this, let's call it boosterism, boosting the ego, actually works. And then there was a really interesting paper trial carried out by Joanna Wood, who's a psychologist in Ontario, Canada. And she carried out a trial in which she created three, randomized to three groups of subjects. And she carried out a raft of psychological measures at baseline and then at 3 and 6 months. And I talk about this in my book, but Joanna Wood gave the first group a bunch of these self-affirming statements. And there's been survey data suggests that up to 50% of North Americans use these self-boosting statements at least once a week. And that had been around in the early 2000s, late 1990s. You know, I'm special. I bring energy and dynamism into whatever room I enter. You know, I'm confident, I'm full of all of those things. And you can, I think you can still download these or get a load of them from the American Self-Esteem Association, you know, called self-affirm. And she tasked that group, the members of that group, with having a kind of a selfie quiet time for 20, or was it 30 minutes a day, in which they focus on those statements and seek to appropriate them for themselves in a positive way. The next group was given the same statements and asked to evaluate them, and with the phrase, how is this true of me and how is this not true of me, for 20, 30 minutes. And the third group was nothing at all. Then she followed them up 3 and 6 months later. What she found was that the change happened in the first group, and people who measured themselves as having low self-worth at the beginning, who had very negative views about their worth and significance, at the end of this period, actually felt worse about themselves. Their self-esteem was lower. And she used the phrase, she said, these self-affirming statements, it's extraordinary that after 4 decades of the self-esteem movement, A, nobody has really got around to doing this kind of evaluation. But B, it's so clear that these help people who already feel good about themselves feel better. So Donald Trump would feel terrific after this 20, 30 minutes. And lots of people would, but people who you might think really need them feel worse. They backfire, she said, for the people who need them most. And of course, the reason for this is because it is just your own propaganda. The self is attempting to define itself, which is the flaw at the heart of the whole project of self-esteem, I think. And indeed, of what identitarianism today or identity, it's the self attempting to define itself. I think it's a psychological cul-de-sac. It is a dead end, because you'll never know whether it's enough. You're never sure whether you got there, and whether you can trust your own judgment. At least that the evidence certainly points that way for worth, self-worth. And at the same time, psychologists like Jean Twenge were mapping the increase of narcissism in society and linking that to boosterism. Jennifer Crocker was showing how people who are becoming excessively focused on maintaining their self-worth in this way, you know, boosting themselves in this way, their empathy levels go down as well, and a number of adverse outcomes. So evidence was accumulated. Not only does it not work, it actually may harm. And that really concerned me. And I wanted to write something for Christians, particularly because I thought I was seeing a lot of pop Christian pastoral care piggybacking onto this. You need to love yourself. You know, you've got to focus on you. This kind of mentality. And I think, you know, you're so special, Jesus died for you. And the cross itself is appropriated in service of the self. And I thought I wanted to write about this. So that's how I got into that book.
So one of the divides that that I'm interested in terms of kind of divided public debates is the intergenerational one. And it's not just intergenerational, it maps a little bit politically as well. But there is a definite sense in which, so the narratives I'm thinking of are the kind of snowflake narratives and the speaking of particularly millennials, top end Gen Z, as just a bit more fragile, generation selfie, the iGen, those kind of narratives, some of which I'm sure has very good and robust research around, and some of which seems to me to be kind of sneery and dismissive about a generation that have faced kind of practically quite a lot of challenges in terms of the way the world they expected has been set up. And full disclosure, I'm a kind of elder millennial, so I sit on that axis, and as I do with many things, I feel like I have a foot in both camps. But how much truth do you see in that narrative? And there's some serious voices speaking about it, and speaking about the necessity of kind of rebuilding in resilience, rebuilding in anti-fragility, and moving away from, you know, the iGen, the selfie culture. Do you see it? Does it worry you? And if it does, what might we do about it in a way that's not just blaming and finger pointing?
Yeah, it really does concern me. I do think there's something in it. Not as much, I think, as you quite rightly point out, Elizabeth, not probably as much as some people would like to think, in that the epidemiologist in me, the scientist, says, well, you know, if you look at the hard data, for example, you'd see claims that depression is on the increase, you know, and anxiety is on the increase. Well, certainly people are using services more. That, I mean, just look at university counseling services. I think there's pretty good evidence coming from there that they're being near overwhelmed with mental health issues. But as you know, this doesn't mean that the true prevalence of those issues is increasing. It could be just that we're more ready to come forward with them. So I'm not the kind of person who would say, oh, yes, we all know that the depression's on the increase as a result of boosterism or as a result of this emphasis on the self. Having said that, I think there is some evidence of increasing mental health problems at a true prevalence level, certainly in the sphere of self-harm, in the sphere of some identity-related issues such as eating disorders, borderline personality, possibly. I mean, the epidemiology is always difficult to really pin down, but I think there is some evidence of increasing mental health issues, which I certainly think it's plausible to link to this cultural shift toward an absorption with ourselves and with our own worth and significance, so on. I think there's something there. I think it goes much deeper than it being a recent cultural phenomenon. I think what's wrong is the way we're trying to deal with it. For example, Francis Fukuyama's book on identity, I think it's a wonderful book myself, and I really think he's on to something, where he says, you know, the root of our tribalism, identity politics, is really the human struggle for recognition, the desire for significance, the desire that not only we have significance, but that other people give us significance. And it's not particularly new. It goes back to Adam Smith. He said exactly the same thing in 1798. You know, it's the desire to be noticed, to be seen, that drives economic ambition and activity. So this is deeply rooted in the human condition, the desire to be known and seen. And I think the good psychological evidence for that. Mark Leahy's experiments, which show how we are highly sensitive to what other people think about us, and our own sense of worth goes up and down depending on how we measure other people's esteem of us. So that there's a lot in this, and you can see the genius of the self-esteem movement comes along in the 50s and 60s and says, this is a problem. If you hitch your sense of inner self-worth and significance to what other people think of you, then, you know, this is contingent. You are always going to be subject to issues, changes outside of your control. Here's what you need to do. You say how much you're worth. Detach yourself, uncouple yourself from other people's approval, and you declare your own worth. So in a way, it's a masterstroke. It does seem, you know, there's a logic to it. The only problem is it doesn't work, as we've seen. And I think what's happened is, as boosterism also actually created or gave more encouragement to expressive individualism, the whole sense of I not only declare my worth, I declare my identity, I say who I am, I get to define myself. As that movement got underway in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and I mean, it's now in every Disney movie, a popular culture, it's all around us. The magic of that offer, you know, you say who you are, it's still there, it's still highly seductive. But the fact that it doesn't work in the end drives us back again to the very thing that we were seeking to avoid, seeking other people's approval. Or it leads us to withdraw and protect ourselves from criticism, from their disapproval of us, in order to preserve this esteem, which, of course, is, as Joanna Wood shows, is so fragile. And I think that's a very plausible explanation for the snowflake phenomenon. I don't like that term because it is pejorative, but, you know, this vulnerability phenomenon that we're seeing around, as well as the anger out there that you have no right to disapprove of me in that way, and thereby to lessen who I am as a person. So I think there's some really interesting cultural streams in play at the moment.
It's so interesting, isn't it, that I feel it and I see it, that hunger for other people to tell us that we're okay, which is what makes, when we have these deep disagreements about big things, so difficult to navigate. You know, I've had conversations with people like James Carey about women in leadership and how difficult I find to talk about that, because it's not just a externalized theoretical debate. And if it's race or gender or any of those things, that the way we conceive of identity right now, which comes with strengths and weaknesses, does seem to make those differences more inflammable, more liable to hurt us, really. And it just makes me think, I want to learn how to navigate them with kindness and with care, but not with fear. And it seems to me we've got, you know, we're either scared and withdrawn, or we're coming out fighting. And the kind of, whatever it is, the formation, the discipleship to be kind of, to be able to, that I've been reading about distress tolerance in the kind of parenting world, of what are the techniques that we can use to manage our fight or flight, always makes me think about Jesus and turn the other cheek. Anyway, that's possibly a cul-de-sac. The last thing I want to talk to you about is sex. So the reason this has come up, well, one of the reasons, is that we did a big study of universities, and it was partly in relation to this narrative, this, you know, oh, safe spaces, aren't these students terrible at dealing with free speech? We must sort out these terrible students, basically, which always slightly, whenever there's a kind of moral panic and you've got a room of researchers, it always kind of raises an eyebrow and they go, what's actually going on? Let's go talk to some people. And so we did a big evaluation, a big study of particularly faith and belief societies on six different campuses, because they're often the sites of these deep disagreements. Them and the feminist society, basically, is where you get controversies. And we found actually that there is quite a lot of moral panic, that mainly students are navigating this quite well, given that they're, you know, 18, 19, 20, and there's quite complicated governance issues, that there's no particular reason to be massively more alarmed than previously. There's a few things that would help them, but it was mainly a kind of, it's not a bigger problem as we thought it was. But we did find a kind of small effect, particularly around socially conservative views, that those students who held those didn't feel able to express them and felt like there was high social stigma around them. And I kind of don't want to get into the details of it, but it, that I kind of wanted to talk to you about it. And the other thing that's triggered it is I invite a whole range of guests, and those who are politically conservative and those who are socially conservative seem much less likely to say yes to me. And I'm interested by that. And I think maybe the sacred sounds a bit woo-woo, possibly. Maybe the Theos network is pretty connected in with academic networks, which has a particular center of gravity. I don't know. I'm interested in it. But you would define yourself as broadly socially conservative, in so much, I would guess, as you take sex seriously and you think that long-term covenant commitment is good for well-being. Do you find it difficult to talk about that in public? And what do you think the effect of that is generally?
People are keen to define you in all kinds of ways, yes. No, but it's a fair description in terms of where we are at the moment. I just say I'm a traditional, you know, I'm in the mainstream of what Christians have thought down through the centuries and what most Christians probably and Orthodox Jews and Muslims believe today about that there's something sacred about sex and that sex is God's gift to be enjoyed as part of our fruitfulness and his gifts in creation within the covenant of marriage. So that's what I but I do think, therefore, that there is some common ground, to be honest, with people who take a different view, in that today most people, I think, would agree. Or come back to me if you disagree, Elizabeth, but most people would agree there's something sacred about sex. There is something about it. If the Me Too movement tells us anything, it's that there's something sacred. You know, you touch me. And it goes to our whole understanding of what it means to be a human being. I think being made sexual in the image of God, being the bodily image of God made sexual, is something that for me is deeply sacred. And I think I'd share that with someone who has a different view on it. In that sense, we common ground, although we disagree about, you know, how you do sex well. I do share that, I think, and appreciate it.
You, your book, forgive me, I've got it written down here, but a better story about sex and human flourishing. You kind of raise questions about the way changing attitudes to sex have contributed to some harms, but you also are really clear, as a Christian, how much good came out of the sexual revolution. And that was an interesting thing for me to read about. What made you think it was really important to say that?
You can't not talk about it. And so I find myself, you know, quite grateful to the sexual revolution, because there is something important. It goes to the very heart of who we are, the desire for intimacy, the desire to be fruitful, to make more of the world. It is, the desire for relationship is deeply woven into what it means to be made in God's image. So I think it's an opportunity for us not to fight back against the sexual revolution, but to take it on the chin and say, what is this saying to us about what we got wrong? And that was certainly my own childhood experience. Nobody talk about it. I came into awareness that I was made sexual all by myself, or stuff I learned at school with all of the others. And this isn't good enough. And I think the sexual revolution in telling us that does us a huge service. And I think simply to lock horns with it simply perpetuates our problem. And our problem is, we know what we're against, but what are we for? That's the question. And, you know, we know what we don't agree with in the sphere of sex, intimacy. But what do we agree? What is our vision of what? You know, why we, what sex is, and why God has made us this way. So I think by making us go back to those questions, it does us a big service. And it does a lot of kids a big service today, where we're able to say to parents, you know, you need to start talking about this whole area with your kids at 5, 6, 7, 8, because the sexual revolution out there is surely talking to them subliminally through images, through its messaging. And if we're to in any way offer something alternative, a different story, then it needs to start early. So what are we for? Well, as what we're against, that's the question.
I was going to ask what you've learned about engaging across difference, but we're out of time. So I'm going to take that last sentence. When you engage across difference, talk about what you're for as well as what you're against, because I think that's a pretty good principle if that's not taking liberties. Glyn Harrison, thank you so much for talking to me on The Sacred.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Sacred. I'm Elizabeth Oldfield. The producer of this episode is Soup Shop Productions, and it is a project of the think tank Theos. We'd really love to hear your thoughts, whether via Twitter at @sacred_podcast, or me at @TheosElizabeth, or thesacredpodcast@gmail.com if it's easier to write in long form. As always, please do rate and share so others can find the podcast. We're also now available on Spotify, so it's even easier to take The Sacred with you wherever you go. Finally, if you'd like to know more about the work of Theos, you can connect via the website at theosthinktank.co.uk.